Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, when you think about human history, there are those of us who wonder which figures had the most influence in their moments on Earth. But human history is more than leaders and great personalities. It's also, would you believe, drugs? Well, how about those drugs' influence on those leaders and great personalities? We'll find out with my guest today, Sam Kelly. He's author of Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And you can follow Sam on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. And Sam, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Good to be here. Happy that we made the show work. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. So tell us, first of all, how did you get interested in this subject? What's your background, and how did you decide to talk about or write about drugs and its impact on history?
So I come at this from a point of view of having always loved history. So I have a bachelor's degree in history from Stanford, but I've been into history ever since I was a little kid. When I was in elementary school, I would ask my teacher if I could bring home the teacher's edition of the textbook so I could get the extra discussion questions and the little extra did you know notes on the side. And when my mom came in the morning to take me to school the next day, she would see that I'd passed out on the bed with the books still open on my chest. So this has been a lifelong thing where I just wanted to know more than what is in the standards, much beyond even what most people would necessarily consider avenues of inquiry that a lot of people wouldn't consider worthwhile. I thought were great adventures. I've always loved taking deep dives into weird things in history, and I kept noticing that a bunch of major historical figures, even in some pretty like mainstream, even in some textbooks at times, they would mention something to do with them doing drugs, but they would like bat it away after a sentence or two and never really follow up on it. But I'd see things like, wait, Sigmund Freud wrote something called Uber Coca, like coca as in cocaine. What is the deal with this? And then I'd dig into it and I would find that there were whole worlds of stories that a lot of people don't even know they're there that are really fascinating, but you just don't hear them in the mainstream tellings of a lot of these stories.
So how did you research it when you decided to do one of these deep dives? And it's a fascinating subject. Was this pre-internet, or did you work on it just online and were able to find things a lot quicker than you would if you had to go to the library and go through the books?
So I use the combination of when it comes to finding deep, rich bodies of information, I have to stick up for like classic libraries. But I find that a great way of finding those books is to look for information online and look at the sources that are cited in like Wikipedia, for instance, see what they deem credible, look at their sources, look at what biographies they're talking about, and those can be great for deep dives. But in terms of some of the preliminary information, if I'm just trying to verify that, okay, is this story actually backed up, or is this just a rumor that I'm hearing? Then it helps to look online and see, can I get cross references from like actual reliable sources? Are there reliable news outlets? Are there academic outlets that I trust that are saying this as well? And if that's the case, then I would say that it would t be time to hit the biography search and start looking for biographies, reading into them. And oftentimes I would find that if there was enough there for it to be mentioned, for there to be biographies mentioned and stuff on it, there would be stuff that was good in the biographies.
That sounds like modern journalism, where you're theoretically supposed to get at least two confirmed sources that will work. And clearly, you did that in your research. So, the interesting part about your search is that you don't limit it to a particular century or a particular decade. You actually go back in time. So, what was the earliest figure? And then, what was the most current figure that you cover in your book?
So I would say that the earliest would probably be people from really ancient history, like Pharaoh Ramses the Great or the Oracle of Delphi, like people who have ascended into the category of myth because they're from so long ago, but we still do have records of what the actual people were like, although obviously those records don't tell us as nearly as much as Let's say that you have someone from the social media era, you can probably learn more about their day-to-day life than you can about someone who lived, thousands of years ago.
But
But
you're completely convinced that in your research, no matter who you checked out, that you had at least those two sources, maybe even more, to confirm that this is the basic reality of the person and the drug.
oh, I got lots of sources for everything. I have a selected bibliography in my book, not the whole thing, because that would be very, very long. But the selected works bibliography is, I think, 35 pages single spaced. So I made sure to find a lot of corroborating sources for all of this stuff. I didn't want to fill people's heads with smoke and mirrors.
And rightly so. What a couple of the we talked about spanning centuries. I just like the idea of spanning individuals. So, for example, there's something on Shakespeare and there's something on the Beatles. So
Yeah.
that kind of frames up where your approach is, and it doesn't limit you to a particular decade or century. You clearly went all in. Who was the most modern figure that you picked for drug use, and was it beneficial to them or was it negative to them?
So there's a couple who you could say as, I mean, in terms of the Beatles, two of them are still alive today, so
Oh, that's
that
sure,
I
I'm
guess
sure.
pretty modern. In terms of someone who is very associated with the modern era but is now deceased, I would say Steve Jobs was a great example of someone who, and in his personal case, he actually believed that, so he admitted on a government security clearance form, he had to list what drugs he'd done in his life to get approval for Apple to do a bunch of government work. And he openly said, yeah, so back in the day, I smoked a lot of marijuana, but what I really, really enjoyed was the LSD. In fact, doing LSD was one of the two or three most important things in my life. And he believed that it helped him, as their old slogan went, to think different. He felt that it helped him appreciate ideas and aesthetics that other people might not want to. And that was his big thing. He was a design guy. So I think that, for instance, he didn't invent the graphical user interface, but another company had the idea of, hey, what if we had like pictures on the screen instead of just text? Like, what if to get rid of a file, we had like a little trash can icon. Wouldn't that be fun? And they're like, no, that's too childish and gimmicky. That'll never work out. But then Steve Jobs, who's done acid, is looking at it and he's like, this is a whole little world on the computer screen, man. It's fascinating. We're creating an entire zone in there. I bet people will love this. And so he has this weird, trippy thought, and it turns out people do love graphical user interfaces. Like the idea of not having icons on our screens now is unthinkable to us.
Sure, it's more practical to have icons than it is to have code.
So yeah, just to have raw text on a flat background, but it took someone to like thinking in ways that had not been the industry standard to get to that point. And what Steve Jobs attributed his ability to think like that was his LSD use.
Now, it's true that drug users throughout the centuries will always rationalize. I'll use that term, I may be wrong, will rationalize how drugs have helped them. But you also have to look at the other side. Have the drugs hurt them? So, what you, with your research, did you come up with a conclusion? Was it a mixed bag? Did in some cases they did help, and in other cases they did not?
It's a very mixed bag. One of the biggest takeaways that I got from this whole thing was the sense that drugs are tools. They're not inherently good or bad. It's about how you use them, what you use them for. Are you using them with knowledge of what it actually entails? And so I found that education and being aware of these things is one of the most helpful ways to determine. And obviously, people who are educated about things can still make decisions that aren't great, but it's easier to make good decisions, I feel, when people are more aware of these things. So yes, some people like Steve Jobs are very pleased with it, but other people, for instance, I mean, take so some of these tend to work out a little bit better than the others. Like some people with the a lot of people like psychedelics, but you know who didn't like psychedelics?
Who's that?
It didn't work out well for the Unabomber. He was involved in the MK Ultra program. He thought that he was just signing up for a psych study when he got to Harvard, but it turns out that for 3 years they were drugging him without his knowledge and then screaming at him to question his beliefs. And so that showed that you could weaponize LSD under these circumstances. Sure. And it broke down his mind. And the government was trying to maybe think, okay, can we build him back up again as an agent? So that they wanted to see if they could, you know, develop mind control, create Manchurian agents, things like that. They couldn't work on that part, but they did break his brain pretty thoroughly to the point where he decided that modern technology was evil and that the whole society was his enemy and he had to go move to a cabin in the woods and send bombs to people. So obviously for him, psychedelics did not go as well because they were used to torture him.
Sure. That's the challenge too, isn't it? Even when a government is experimenting with that, they have to really be careful what they're doing because you can create maybe not a Manchurian candidate, but you can create a monster who will then go out and do horrendous things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you can create a very violently, mentally unstable person, especially with the one of the big things was that they were giving him drugs without his knowledge. And so if someone's given LSD, but at least they know they've been given LSD, when things start getting really weird around them, they can be, okay, well, this makes sense because I am tripping on acid right now. So it is logical that my situation has gotten bizarre. But he doesn't know that he's been given any LSD. He doesn't really know what that is. So as far as he's concerned, he is going insane and the walls are melting and these, you know, the accusations of his interrogators, they told him he was going to have a collegial debate with another student, but instead they sent, you know, CIA interrogators to try and break him down. So all of that was just so much worse because he had no idea what was being done to him.
It seems that the guardrails should be two things. One is information, correct information to the subject or the volunteer, and consent. But you give the information first because that sounds horrible in terms of it. Clearly what he did later on, it doesn't take away from what he did, but you can understand the beginnings of it as you explained it. So, yeah, that's interesting. When you look back in all of the different examples, did you find an additional divide in this sense? Those people who, okay, drugs may help me, but they may not help me, but also what were there those that say, I'm going to take the drugs, but only under the supervision of a medical professional versus some who think that they know everything and they're going to just take their own medicine, their own drugs and their own dosage. And, you know, whatever comes.
Oh, yes. There's a huge difference between someone like Alexander the Great, who drank and used opium recreationally all the time, and someone like Marcus Aurelius, who was prescribed opium by his doctor, because Marcus Aurelius, being this classic philosopher king, could not turn his brain off. So at night he would just lie awake in bed thinking about stoicism. And so his doctor told him, hey, you know, this juice of the poppy, this opium stuff, this can get you medicated enough to sleep. And so he just takes it for medical purposes. There's no indication that he ever took it for recreational purposes. And a similar thing with George Washington took opium both to sleep and to deal with the fact that he had those nightmare Frankenstein teeth.
Yeah, the wooden teeth, yeah.
not wooden teeth. He wishes he had wooden teeth. The truth is even crazier. And that's part of why I love
him. Tell us the truth then, Sam. Tell us the truth. I always thought it was wooden teeth.
That's part of what they tell you, because the real story is it seems almost tangential and is very dark, because a lot of those teeth were not – they were human teeth. A lot of them were taken from corpses, but a lot of them were taken from slaves, like enslaved people that he owned. And some of the rest of them were actually teeth from, I think, like animals and stuff like that.
What a combination. Wow.
Yeah. And so they were crudely, haphazardly wired together, and they actually still have the real dentures displayed in the Mount Vernon Museum, and it's terrifying. It is like just this Frankensteinian nightmare of mismatched monster teeth, and it is very easy to see how having that in his mouth would cause him agonizing pain.
Yeah, it might be even better to go without teeth, just not to deal with it.
But then if he doesn't have teeth, he can't talk. And how do you lead a nation if you can't talk?
That is true. You become toothless. Yes,
Yeah.
exactly. Okay, fair enough. And as a leader, you can't afford to be looking like you're toothless. So, yeah, that makes sense.
So you notice in all the pictures and in obviously they're not, pictures that we have today, but all the paintings and all the depictions of him, he is never smiling. His mouth is always closed and he always looks like kind of awkward and uncomfortable. And that's because his teeth don't fit in his mouth right, and he has to be medicated just so that he can bear having the teeth he needs to speak, to lead. So they deemed that in order to be the president of the United States, they just have to keep giving him opium because otherwise he wouldn't have the skills necessary.
Well, I want to go back to the Beatles for a second because we talk about, and you mentioned Jobs as well, Steve Jobs. So there is a connection, and it doesn't always work, but there is a connection between drugs and creativity. And I don't think drugs necessarily makes a non-creative person creative. Maybe an accountant, maybe it does creative accounting, but other than that, I don't think it would. But with the Beatles, based on your research, did the drugs help them in terms of not performance, because they were pretty good without any drugs performing, but in terms of writing lyrics or melodies?
It seems like the in terms of both like writing lyrics and writing the melodies and also some of the sound design type stuff, the drugs did seem to have pretty significant influences in how they developed. Like you can sort of trace a long time as they get into different drugs and their taste like sort of shifts to focus on things that are better with some stuff. Like if I remember correctly, like Rubber Soul is like their weed influenced album, and then with Sgt. Pepper they get more into the LSD stuff, and you see along with that they go from being sort of like just kind of longer haired guys to having the full psychedelic outfits and the full so it definitely influences a lot of their design choices. And yeah, they tried to avoid consuming it when they were actually performing because they didn't find that consuming stuff like weed or cannabis or like weed or LSD helped them when they were actually on stage, but they did seem to get a lot out of it as a creative tool. But obviously, there was also a lot of problematic drug use in that group, so it wasn't all sunshine and daisies.
I have an idea for your next book. And Chris, you're speaking of drugs and someone who unfortunately just passed away, Brian Wilson. That could be a book in itself in terms of what he was taking and who he had to deal with going back to the 70s even. And it created all this wonderful music for that will live on forever. And yet he obviously had to take various drugs, some prescription, some non-prescription, meaning not legally prescribed. But that was a whole thing over many, many years. And so that might be another book for you after this one.
No, it's definitely such a fascinating subject. And Brian Wilson, certainly, I'm going to be doing research into him. And if not like a full book, then certainly in there's plenty of people who just didn't make the cut for this book, not because they weren't interesting, but simply because I just had to cut it off at a certain point. So certainly there's a lot more material for another book like this, and Brian Wilson would definitely be in a book like that.
Yeah, I would hope so. Yeah, a part two book once the this one. Yeah, no, it makes sense. Have you ever thought about, because of your background, you mentioned about a BA in history, have you thought about going for a master's or PhD in history? Because you obviously have the talent for it and you have the interest and curiosity for it. Have you thought about that?
Thank you for that. I actually have considered it. For a while, I wasn't exactly sure how I wanted to go about my goal of. So I love sharing knowledge and I love storytelling. And so I wanted to find a way that I could do that as a career. And because I was really lucky in school to have so many great history teachers and later in college history professors who were amazing storytellers and who inspired me in my love of history, I thought, for a while, okay, maybe I want to go into like a formal academic environment, like actually be in a classroom or be in academia and be teaching there. And I even was for about 6 months in a master's degree at the University of Pennsylvania to get them for teaching, to teach in classrooms. But I found that a lot of things about formal classroom teaching weren't necessarily best suited to my interests. Like one of them is, and I just want to say, it's really hard to be a teacher or a professor, and I have so much respect for what these people do and how much extra unpaid work and emotional labor they have to take on outside of the classroom. And like they don't, no one writes their syllabuses for them. No one writes their lesson plans for them. They have to remember, like 150 different faces and grade all these papers. And there was just, I was great at connecting with people and sharing stories in the classroom, but there was so much other red tape stuff and bureaucratic stuff. And now, especially with all the sort of like political and culture war stuff, it seems like it's tougher even than it was before to get formally into academia, especially if you're just starting out. And writing the book and being able to not be a part of like an official institution, I felt freed me up to say a lot of stuff where if I was part of like part of the way I've built it is that stuff they don't teach you in school. Because I imagine that even if this stuff is totally true and I can back it up, I would probably get a lot of heat for like, oh, you're telling our kids these things that are it's easier to be outside that system, certainly right now.
Yeah, I could see. I think we'll call you the pop historian. So that could work. Again, the book is called Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. And it's written by Sam Kelly, who we're talking with, or I'm talking with. There's no we, it's just me. So, Sam, when you started to put it all together and you decided how far back you wanted to go and how current you wanted to go, how did you work that out? In other words, you could go back to the very beginning of time, I would imagine. There may not be enough research available for that, but how did you pick your parameters?
I intentionally define things incredibly broadly because part of my goal is to send the message that, hey, I know that the way that history is presented by a lot of people is often very dry and seems bland, but if it's properly presented, this is really fascinating material, and it's like if people say that history is boring, everything that's ever happened is history, right? So how can everything that's ever happened be boring? If I look at the entire span of human existence, like I'm pretty sure that I can find plenty of entertaining anecdotes here. And so that was the goal, was just to not limit myself by any time period, but also to show, because I felt that a lot of people who I talked to in school just didn't seem to have a comprehension that people did drugs before there were like anti-drug PSAs. Like they seem to think that, people just started doing drugs in the 60s and it had never happened before. And it's like, no, this is from ancient history. Like people have been using cannabis and opium and alcohol since before they were using writing. Like there's so I wanted to show the whole range of it. And the only thing that really constrained me in how far I could go into the present was that it's obviously better not to write about anyone who's currently living unless that person is just extremely open and honest and has, in their own words, said, "Yes, I did these drugs." Hence why the Beatles are in there, because Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney are cool about it and they admit things. But there were other people who will not be named who I thought about, and it's like, well, even if they've admitted to this stuff in the past, might they sue me? Yes, they might. And so, dead men tell no tales, they say. Well, history tells their tales, but dead men file no suits. And that.
It's true. Well, technically, yes, they do, because you could have the estate of the dead person sue you.
This is the fascinating thing. We actually looked this up. And so if they're still alive, then even if what they say is true, they could arguably sue you for damaging their commercial prospects and like say my reputation's important to my business, say. But if someone is dead, then truth is an absolute defense about anything you might say about them. So even if it's insanely unflattering, if that person is deceased, their estate cannot, that is considered a frivolous lawsuit. This is the kind of stuff that I had to look up when I was figuring out who to write
I
about.
understand. No, I guess I'm very lucky because A, I'm alive, not dead, and two, I don't do drugs, so you've got nothing on me, Sam. So, well, when you're researching all these different interesting personalities, and it's a long list. If you want to share a few extra people that you wrote about, you don't have to get into the specifics, but just to give people a sense of the breadth of the type of people that you covered, because it goes on, as I say, from the very beginning. There was Shakespeare, there was the Beatles, Judy Garland, Carl Sagan, who else am I thinking of? Vincent Van Gogh. You can name a few others. You
The Van
all.
Gogh is crazy one. Look, that's a crazy one. When I first heard that Vincent Van Gogh literally ate paint, at first I thought it was a mean-spirited joke. I'm like, oh, hey, come on. I know the guy had problems, but then I look it up and I find on the Van Gogh Museum website in Amsterdam, like, is it true that Van Gogh ate paint? And they're like, yes, it is true. He ate a lot of paint. Yeah, his favorite flavor was yellow. Like
Well, he
it's
was on a budget. He couldn't afford food, so what are you going to
I mean, he also was just really, really mentally disturbed. I think he liked the terpenes, that the smell chemicals in the paint. And
Could
I
be.
think the best way to get them into him was to eat it. He just had a lot of stuff that was going wrong with him. He's a tragic case in that I really feel like it obviously did not help his sanity that he was eating paint and had to be stopped from drinking turpentine by his roommate. But I'm pretty sure that he already was not in a good place, even without the paint eating.
What was the most interesting fact you discovered? I know it's a broad question based on all the research you've done, but is there one that sticks out to you that amazed you when you came across it?
So one that actually became surprisingly timely recently was, so you know, there's recently been a new pope elected by the conclave, right? The Pope Francis passed away, and so the new pope is Pope Leo the 14th, right? And so most popes are named after a very esteemed successor. Pope Leo the 13th is in my book. Pope Leo the 13th, who is again very respected within the Catholic Church, drank cocaine wine, and he loved the cocaine wine so much he gave a Vatican gold medal to the creator of the cocaine wine, and then appeared in a full-page advertisement for the cocaine wine, which is reprinted in my book. Now,
Excellent.
yeah, but you gotta consider this was totally legal at the time,
Of
and so
course.
this same substance called Vin Mariani, Queen Victoria drank it, Thomas Edison drank it, Ulysses S. Grant drank it, and so this guy, I think, in the history of the Catholic Church, there have been about 300 encyclicals, these big important speeches of doctrine. He wrote 80 of them. And again, he was like in his 70s and into his 90s when he was Pope. So he just had so much energy because he was always drinking cocaine wine. And he stated that he drank it, quote, to fortify myself when prayer is insufficient. This guy's amazing. And this is the
Yeah.
guy who the current Pope is named
I
after.
love it. Well, before I let you go, we have about a minute left. What would you like readers to take away from your book?
I think really the two biggest themes are that drugs are tools. They're not inherently good or bad. It's about knowing how to use them in education. And tying right into the education doesn't have to be boring. History definitely isn't boring. This is exciting and fun material. It can be a lot of fun to learn if you've got a good storyteller telling you the story.
Great way to leave it. My guest has been Sam Kelly. He's author of Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. It's available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and all the usual places. And you can follow Sam on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. And Sam, thanks for being on the show.
Great to be here.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.